This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. There are plans to make permanent new outdoor dining opportunities in Cincinnati, but one neighborhood council isn't thrilled with the process. And Cincinnati Public Schools plans for a return to the classroom and adopts an anti-racism policy. We begin the weekly news review with WVXU reporters Jolene Almendarez. Jolene, welcome.
Hi, thanks, Michael.
And Corey Sharber. Hi, Corey.
Hey.
Jolene, let's start with you because we actually have some additional news that developed late this morning. We are now back to a full city council in Cincinnati after Hamilton County Probate Court Judge Ted Winkler named Republican Liz Keating to temporarily replace P.G. Sittenfeld, the Democrat, who is currently suspended from council while he's being investigated on federal corruption charges. What can you tell us, Jolene?
Right. So Keating is a native Cincinnati person, and she's the marketing director at the Jim Stengel Company. But you probably know her because her grandfather is really prominent in the community. Her grandfather, William J. Keating, was a congressman, former publisher of the Cincinnati Inquirer, and also part of a prominent law firm in town. And so she was appointed this morning. She's technically not sworn in yet, but she says that something that's been upsetting to her is that people have just been putting a lot of focus on the scandals that have been happening at City Hall in the past month, sort of. And she really wants to see people bring the attention back to Cincinnati residents. Now, she pointed out that with the COVID-19 issues that are happening, that she wants to focus on restoring the community. And she's particularly excited to help families, especially with the high rate of children living in poverty in the city. So that's what we got from this morning.
Jolene, we've learned a lot about strange processes involving city government when issues like the ones we've been experiencing late this year involving council members develop. So we now know that a probate court judge can appoint a temporary replacement when someone has to be suspended or step aside from the council for criminal investigations. What did Judge Ted Winkler have to say about why he chose Keating? Do you know?
Yes. He actually said that he was looking for somebody with fresh ideas, a lot of energy. He said he wanted to pick someone who had just a history of serving the people in Cincinnati. He pointed out Keating's work, nonprofit work in the community. She's worked with a lot of different nonprofits, but one or volunteered. And one he pointed out was that she helps with an adoption group that he works with in his court. And so he said that the decision made sense. He felt like she'd been passed over for appointments in the past, and that's the reason why she stood out above the rest of the candidates.
All right, Jolene, we'll come back to you in a moment. We are working to set up a conversation with Councilwoman Liz Keating after she's sworn in, of course, in early January. So stay tuned for that. Corey Sharber is also with WVXU and joins us via Zoom as well. Corey, I understand that Cincinnati Public Schools is planning to return to some sort of blended learning model. What can you tell us from recent Board of Education discussions?
Right. So, of course, this has been an ongoing process this entire school year. As you know, that earlier this year, it's been really difficult for kids to keep going to school, mainly due to the pandemic just going up and going down as time has gone on. And of course, last semester, they returned to distance learning due to a lack of staffing caused by COVID-19. So this new plan that they're trying to present, they would essentially go back to the blended learning model they implemented last semester. They won't know when they can go back until they review data further. So what they're planning on doing is they want to look at the data they want to start reviewing data January 2nd. And on January 16th, if Cincinnati is able to maintain a limit of having 40 cases per 100,000 people, if they can go below that, we could see pre-K and specialized classrooms returning on February 1st.
So did you hear from parents this time around, Corey? I know that we've heard from board members and parents as these conversations have gone on since the semester returned.
I haven't really heard much from parents this time around. I know that earlier this year, there's basically a huge divide amongst parents and guardians about keeping their kids in school or keeping their kids distance. It's pretty much a, you know, 50-50 split across the board. And of course, you know, with there's a lot of risk involved when it comes to this sort of thing. I mean, with having kids, when you have kids with blended learning, you do have them in class and having, you know, discussions with teachers and whatnot, but it promotes a huge risk when it comes to, you know, spreading COVID or contracting COVID, even though within the schools, they haven't really seen a lot of instances of students spreading the virus. But even with that, when everyone's outside of the school, the staff members have been getting really sick. Now, with distance learning, you pretty much eliminate that risk of spreading COVID within the school buildings, but it makes education a lot harder.
Corey, we've talked about an anti-racism policy explored by the school board on this program in a long segment also involving students. Previously, I believe it was over the summer. That has been adopted now. Can you tell our listeners what that means to have an anti-racism policy at Cincinnati Public Schools?
Right. The anti-racism policy is mainly the board stating that they're looking at ways of dismantling, you know, systemic racism within the school district. Now, with that being said, this is more or less kind of a building block. I think they're going to be looking back on this further to further implement some things. The most that comes out of this is that, you know, staff members will now be, you know, subject to like anti-racism training, and they'll be doing self-evaluations every year. And they'll also be including this policy within the student handbook as well.
And we're also joined by Jolene Almendarez from right here at WVXU. Jolene, we've seen a lot of people eating outside lately as local governments try to allow restaurants to retain some sort of business during this pandemic where we need to limit the indoor dining. It looks like there's an effort afoot to make this permanent in Cincinnati, but we heard from a neighborhood council in recent days that expresses not everyone's on board with this, at least not with how it's going so far. What can you tell us?
Oh, gosh, I might need the whole hour. No, so really what the issue here is nobody in anywhere is saying that restaurants shouldn't have basically the extended ability to have outdoor seating. There's nobody on council or nobody in local neighborhoods saying that. However, in Over the Rhine, the Central Business District, and Pendleton, the city proposed a permanent outdoor dining expansion. So long story short, some roads will be closed and sidewalks will be extended to make these areas more pedestrian friendly and really install this ideology long term. And the OTR Community Council basically said that the city violated its own commitment to present to community councils about what they planned on doing in communities, confer with them, get feedback from them about anything going on. The council says, no, actually, that we sent out a notice. It's been about 2 weeks. You've had time to reach out to us. The community council's kind of shot back at that and said, well, you technically never presented at us. You never got a vote from us. And there's just a lot of drama about how this entire process went down. Now, so, OTR, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, Jolene, what happens next? I mean, we did watch early this week as this was discussed, but I mean, is this now policy? Has this been decided?
It has. You know, city council, even though not everyone agreed with the process, everyone voted for it. And OTR now about $2 million, the first phase of this is $2 million TIF dollars are going to go toward infrastructure changes that are needed to make this change permanent. And city council is saying that they'd like to engage OTR in the process to look at some of their concerns, which included how this impacts the residents living nearby, pedestrian safety and traffic.
And according to your reporting, Jolene, Mayor John Cranley said that this is more than just helping during the pandemic. This is something that makes Cincinnati more attractive in, quote, the long term. He said, according to your reporting, quote, and for cities to be vibrant, we have to do the things that we as a group and a city council have been preaching for years, which is to give people an option that isn't so car dependent, to give people walkable downtowns and over the Rhines, to give people really great outdoor eating opportunities. We'll continue to follow the latest out of City Hall and the Board of Education with our friends Jolene Almendarez and Corey Sharber, who have joined us today via Zoom. Jolene, Corey, thank you for the time. Happy holidays to you both. See you soon.
Thanks for
having us.
And gun-related legislation is back in conversation in Columbus, so are fireworks. And FC Cincinnati's West End Soccer Stadium was a big winner in some funding. Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Jesse Balmer joins us now via Zoom to talk about it. Jesse, welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me.
So before we went on the air, Jesse, you were saying if you thought the lame duck General Assembly session was ending, it's now in extra innings. What did you mean by that?
So there are a number of large pieces of legislation that haven't passed one or both chambers. For example, you talked about gun legislation. There is a bill that would eliminate the duty to retreat before shooting in self-defense in more places, basically anywhere you have a legal right to be. That was added pretty late last night in the House, and that would still need Senate approval. We also have things like the override of Governor Mike DeWine's veto that is still in limbo, and any sort of resolution to this nuclear plant bailout.
That's House Bill 6. I think a lot of people are now familiar with it under that title. So what's the timeline? How long is there a lame duck?
Technically, we could keep going until December 31st. That would be the end of the two-year session, but I think we're going to not do that. The Ohio Senate is meeting today to vote on some of these measures. The Ohio House is expected to be back next week to finish some things up. House Bill 6, there is a move to delay it for a year, and the House was struggling to get the votes to do even that. And so I think they want to try again another day.
What's the ruckus I'm hearing about fireworks out of Columbus, possibly loosening some regulations on them?
Yeah, so there's a proposal. I think as you and your listeners would know, Ohio has a weird law on fireworks. You can buy them here, but you have to take them out of the state, and no one really does that, and no one is really enforcing that. And so there's been a push to change that for years, and it's been very slow going. So the latest proposal would take one small step in that direction, and the step would be local municipalities could okay fireworks use for certain days, July 3rd through the 5th, if they wanted to. Now, that still needs a last okay in the Ohio House, so it's, again, one of those other things up in the air. But it would be a step towards legalizing fireworks in some format, with proponents of legalizing fireworks saying, like, we could push this further down the line later.
Now, this July 3rd through the 5th recommendation or potential policy, that comes after, I think I read that one chamber wanted maybe all year round?
Yeah, that was the initial proposal. And like a lot of things in the legislature, you get to the end of the session and the name of the game is getting what you can get. And so this is a like less forceful compromise, possibly.
Well, we'll continue to follow that through the end of the year. Let's talk about what has been done, apparently. You wrote earlier this week that Ohio lawmakers are ready to dole out $16 million for this new stadium that's next to our studio here for FC Cincinnati here in the West End. How much?
Yeah, so it's $16 million. It's actually the largest item in Ohio's capital budget, which is a $2.1 billion bill, but the part that usually gets the most attention are the local projects, and that's closer to $171 million, and $16 million is the biggest ticket item on that whole list. It is actually in line with what the state gave to the Columbus Crew when they're building a new stadium downtown there. So the FC Cincinnati got about $4 million in the last capital budget. We're adding 16, so that brings you up to 20.
So what exactly is this to be used for? Is it just general construction costs for the FC Cincinnati Stadium?
It's supposed to be for infrastructure, and like there's another $1 million in there for the parking garage. So in theory, the stadium isn't being spent, taxpayer dollars isn't being spent on the stadium, but there's plenty of taxpayer dollars from both the city and the state that are being spent around the stadium. So it might be semantics.
So the FC Cincinnati Stadium got a pretty huge chunk of change, but it's not the only local project that received funding or expected to receive funding from this legislation. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the other local projects?
Yeah, there's the River Park.
Smale, yeah.
There's money for like the museum and for the opera. There's a lot. Basically, this bill is to help locals kind of work on buildings or projects. Usually universities also get some money out of this as well. So there's a whole list you can read on cincinnati.com. But the largest items got closer to $1 million, and some projects got closer to $20,000.
Well, Jesse Baumert, I know you're spending a lot of time paying attention to the legislature, as you always do. And obviously, COVID is also dominating headlines and our everyday lives. What's going on with COVID cases within the legislature at this point? We talked about it just last week with our friends from Ohio Public Radio. But 7 days later, are we still seeing any new cases among lawmakers there?
Yeah, so what happened yesterday was there was two lawmakers who did not come to session because their relatives had tested positive for COVID-19. And one of those lawmakers, John Cross from near the Toledo area, had been experiencing symptoms himself. And so the goal is obviously not to bring it to the Ohio legislature and spread it around, but there have been a number of lawmakers who've already tested positive for COVID. There are two House Democrats who are actually hospitalized with how serious this has become. So, and there's also been this push to either from Representative Bridget Kelly in the Cincinnati area, Hyde Park, has asked for hearings or maybe session to be done virtually so you aren't potentially contaminating more people. But those have all been rejected. A proposal to require masks on the House floor has been rejected. So there's kind of this disconnect between the fact that we are having more cases in the Ohio House particularly and not really mandating anything to improve the situation.
Are there lawmakers operating inside a building there without wearing masks?
Yes.
Jesse Baumert from the Cincinnati Inquirer, we always appreciate your reporting and your willingness to come on our air and share some of it with us. We'll talk again soon, I hope. Jesse, thank you. Happy holidays to you.
Great. You too.
And coming up, we have updates on the dueling observation wheels and music venues in Cincinnati and Newport. And later, the 1850 Christmastime Meat Parade here in Cincinnati. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Hamilton County Commissioners took a pay cut this year due to COVID-19, but one member inquired about maybe getting that money back. And will we still have in the future two large observation wheels on the riverfront on both sides? Inquirer reporter Scott Wortman joins us via Zoom now. Scott, welcome back to our show.
Well, thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
It is, and I am looking forward to the day where we could either ride an observation wheel together and talk about the news or wave at one another from across the Ohio River, one in Newport, one in Cincinnati. But before we dive into that, let's talk about what went down at the Hamilton County Commission. This is Commissioner Stephanie Dumas, who asked about having pandemic pay cut returned.
Yes. Earlier, at the start of the pandemic, the county made a drastic cuts. They furloughed 240 employees because they didn't know basically, you know, what the revenue situation was going to be like at the end of the year. And the commissioners took a 10% pay cut. They get paid about $100,000 annually, depending on when they took office. The state raised their salary a year or two ago. But yeah, they get paid about $100,000 a year. But it turned out, thanks in part to a tax hike that the commissioners enacted last year, where they extended the quarter cent sales tax that paid for the Union Terminal renovations, that is now going to the general fund for county operations. So their revenue situation was not as bad as feared. They haven't actually, for the first time in years, haven't had to make any drastic cuts. So I got an email from a resident about 2 weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, saying, look into a commissioner asking for having her pay cut restored back to her. Didn't say which commissioner it was. So I put in an open records request, and turned out that Commissioner Stephanie Dumas had asked staff, since the revenue situation wasn't so bad, if she could have, if it was possible to return the $10,000 that that the commissioners gave up in their salary.
And so, Scott, what was the response?
If it were to happen, it would have to happen before the end of the year, because the auditor cannot give an elected official a salary that's higher than what's in statute.
And that's because the Hamilton County Commission salaries are set at the state level.
Correct. Yes. By state law. I called Commissioner Dumas whether, hey, are you going to actually request this refund? Because she never submitted a formal request. She was just inquiring about it via staff. And her response was, I just was curious. I wanted to know if it was possible. I was also asking for others, whoever that may be, I guess other employees, I don't know, whether this was possible. But she said that she is not pursuing this. And so as of now, no commissioners have submitted a request for a refund. Now, all the commissioners are expected to submit letters asking for their full pay to be reinstated for the coming year, but no commissioners now, I guess after this has been brought to light, no commissioners are asking for $10,000 to be returned to them.
We're talking with Scott Wartman, a reporter at the Cincinnati Inquirer. Well, Scott, thank you for that report. Let's talk observation wheels. So we know good and well that there are dueling plans to have large observation wheels on both the banks in Cincinnati and on the Newport Riverfront as well. And I guess the question you had when you started poking around again is, what's the deal with these things? Has the pandemic disrupted their progress? Are we still going to have them? So what did you find out?
Well, yeah, I mean, if the world didn't end this year, we were supposed to, within the next few months, by March, have two giant glowing spinning wheels on the riverfront. If we do still have that, it's going to be a little longer. The one in Newport, the status of that is unknown. The city officials over there, there was supposed to be a 230-foot tall Ferris wheel that was going to go up between the aquarium and Newport on, but whether that's going to happen or not, the levy isn't saying, the company that's building it isn't saying, and the city of Newport said it's not our project, so we don't know. Now, the one on the Ohio side, that seems like it could still be a go. The county officials and people at the banks said that they've talked to the company. They're still bullish, as the bank's general manager told me, on opening up a new 180-foot tall glowing Ferris wheel sometime at some point. Actually, we have absolutely no idea when, but that they still plan on opening at the banks. It'll just be longer. They were hoping to open up by March. But that's not going to happen.
So we had Sky Star. I sometimes get these mixed up. There's Sky Star, yeah, and there's Sky Wheel. Is Sky Star?
I don't know what's confusing about that.
Not only that, we should point out, Scott, that they're made by two different companies who both happen to be based in St. Louis for some reason, the observation wheel capital of North America.
Yeah, I guess it's the land of Ferris wheels. I don't know.
Well, the temporary one that was on the banks in Cincinnati was really popular enough for that company to determine that this was a market they wanted, yes, to be in on a permanent basis. But I guess because of the setup, for those of us who have been inside of it, we know that it would probably violate COVID protocols, right? It's a small enclosed space. And so, you really can't be doing that right now. So I'm wondering what the overall impact is. And it looks like you didn't hear back from the company that's building,
correct,
the one for Newport.
No one seems to want to talk about, you know, the future of Ferris wheels, I guess. I don't know. It's up in the air. And I have not seen much literature on the state of the Ferris wheel industry. So, they're not saying publicly. Evidently, according to the county officials, they are talking to county administrators, saying that they still want to open. But yeah, they're not making any public statements on or any public promises on coming back.
So we wait, as we do so well these days, for a lot of things. But what do folks around the banks have to say about it? Businesses that may not be, you know, technically associated with the SkyWheel, but or Sky, what is it again?
Yeah.
SkyStar, well, Sky, which one is it? What are the businesses?
No, the one on the Cincinnati side is the Sky. It took me a while to remember it as well, but I've had to write enough about it. The Cincinnati one, SkyStar, the Newport one, SkyWheel.
Okay, gotcha. So Sky.
I don't have a mnemonic device to remember by. You just gotta practice.
And so, what are businesses around the bank saying about this? Are they eager for it to come back?
Yeah. Well, I mean, their standard philosophy, if you're a business owner at the banks, is anything that can attract people down there. And this wheel surprisingly turned out to be a big draw. I mean, according to the company, after 10 months, they had 250,000 rides at about, I believe it's $12 a pop. But it turned out to be a very popular attraction down there in front of the Freedom Center. And basically, I mean, it was just pretty. I mean, it was a welcome addition to the skyline, a whimsical addition to the skyline that people just really, really liked and liked having there. And I guess, I mean, what town doesn't need more whimsy?
This is why we enjoy having you on, Scott. And so on the Newport side, though, I mean, the city was involved in certain approval process. Obviously, as you noted, the city manager there, Tom Frommey, said that this is not a city project. They just did what they needed to do to approve it. And they seemed eager and enthusiastic. But I got the impression from your article that they were kind of, you know, basically saying, what are we supposed to know about this?
Yeah, well, the city has made all the approvals, as have the feds, the Army Corps of Engineers, which was the biggest hurdle because it's being built on top of a flood wall. They've approved everything. It's right now in the hands of Newport-on-the-Levee and the Ferris wheel operators, and they have not indicated one way or the other whether they're still doing it or not. And again, it's much like with the music venues I don't that are being built on opposite ends of the banks. I don't know what the market is for two giant Ferris wheels. I mean, maybe there is. I don't know.
I guess we will find out. We'll continue to follow. Inquirer reporter Scott Sky Wartman has been our guest today via Zoom. Scott, happy holidays to you. Thanks for the time you gave us.
You too. Take care.
You too. And as you heard Scott mention there, not only do we have these dueling observation wheels, maybe on the way, maybe not, but we have dueling music venues on both sides of the riverfront. They are moving forward. We can see them with our own eyes. And here to talk about it via Zoom is Business Courier reporter Tom Demiropoulos. Tom, welcome back to our show.
Thanks, Michael. Happy to be here.
Well, we're glad that you're here. And we were just talking with Scott Wartman about the Ferris wheels or the observation wheels, which seem to be up in the air right now. But we know for sure that the music venues are moving forward because we see the construction. What's the status of both of them?
Yes, both of these music venues are definitely happening as construction is almost complete on both of them. So on the Cincinnati side, we have the Andrew J. Brady Icon Music Center at the Banks, which is about a $25 million project. Mike Smith tells me that project is expected to be complete in the first week of February. And then over in Newport, Corprex is working on the Ovation Music Pavilion. And that project, which is part of a $40 million venue that sits on top of a 550-car parking garage, is expected to be substantially complete here in the next couple of weeks.
Certainly. I mean, again, you can see this happening. We've watched construction throughout this pandemic. Construction was considered an essential industry, and so these workers have been out there this entire time building. What's interesting, Tom, is that they've been building music venues in a time where music venues are shut down. What did you hear from those involved in the development in terms of I don't know, concerns or optimism about opening such ambitious projects when the music industry and the entertainment industry has been impacted so majorly?
Yeah, so both venues are expecting there to be kind of a lot of demand for when they are able to open. That's a tough question to answer in terms of at what time will they kind of be able to open the doors up. From talking with people in the industry, it sounds like they're expecting sometime in the second quarter of 2021 to be able to start hosting shows, and they're already in the process of going out to artists and managers to kind of see when acts are going to be out performing on the road and when they might be able to bring them here to Greater Cincinnati at one of these venues.
That'll be something to keep an eye out for. Hopefully next year, as these vaccines start to roll out, we'll continue to monitor that. Another deal going on downtown is the Millennium Hotel, and that's something we've talked about on this program multiple times. I guess there's not going to be any dynamite involved in bringing this thing down?
Yeah, it looks like there will not be an implosion after all. Earlier this year, the Port of Greater Cincinnati Development Authority, which is kind of handling the repositioning of the former headquarters hotel for Cincinnati, had said that they were thinking about using an implosion to bring down at least one of the towers, because the Millennium Hotel is a two-tower hotel complex. After months of due diligence and kind of figuring out the logistics of bringing a building down in a tight urban core, they've decided that the risks are just looking like they'll be too high. So it'll be a purely mechanical demolition process. And for those who aren't familiar with the building, there's another building directly adjacent to it, the 8451 headquarters. And it's literally like I could stand between the buildings and touch the walls of both. So it's a very, very tight site. So I understand why it would be probably likely to have to take it down bit by bit in a very methodical and tedious way.
Is that what is meant by mechanical demolition?
Yeah, so they'll bring in heavy equipment to kind of take down each piece a little bit at a time, so it doesn't damage anything else. And there's actually a number of other things that they have to be cognizant of as they're taking this building down. There is a chilled water loop that runs throughout downtown that a lot of the buildings use. That runs directly through the hotel's basement, so that's got to stay in service during demolition. There are some telecommunications lines that are going to have to be rerouted. So this will be a pretty complex demolition project.
So the Millennium Hotel is closed down. It had some problems there at the end of its life, but it was the largest hotel in downtown Cincinnati, and now it's coming down. What do we know about what's to replace it?
So those plans are really still up in the air. I think COVID has really put the brakes on in terms of figuring out exactly what is going to go there, just because the convention and travel business has been so impacted by COVID-19. It's kind of given our leadership a little bit of time actually to figure out what's the best reuse, what does it look like, how big, what are we trying to serve here, should there be an expansion of the convention center. So all those things are still in progress as they're working on bringing the old hotel down.
We're talking with Tom Demiropoulos from the Cincinnati Business Courier. Let's talk about another hotel, a $40 million local hotel and a brewery, landing a pretty significant tax credit.
Yes, so the Manchester Hotel in Middletown. This is a project that could be a huge redevelopment play in the heart of Middletown. They received they were awarded a $4 million Ohio Historic Preservation Tax Credit on Thursday, and that is expected to be part of a very complex capital stack to move that project forward. Now, in speaking with getting some information from the city of Middletown, I don't know if they're as
optimistic?
As positive or as sure that this project will move forward in its current rendition. I think they're kind of looking at seeing what's going to happen here, because this is a project, Michael, that's been on the books for a long time. We first wrote about it back in 2014. So you're talking about 6 years that that this has been in some form of redevelopment work. So we're waiting to see kind of what the next step is. But they do have this, and that tech chart, I believe, is transferable. So we'll have to see what comes of that project.
What gives the city officials pause? Is it just, I saw in your article the term capital stack use, which I think usually means there's a variety of different funding sources needed to make a project like this work.
Yes. So this is, as I said, it's a $40 million project, and they just have the $4 million state historic tax credit. They're also eligible for a federal historic tax credit. But I think they're looking to make sure that the developer has the other equity and debt sources to move forward on a project this size. And I think it's the fact that it's taken so long that there's been so many years without something happening there that they're kind of it gives them pause to. They don't quite want to celebrate just yet. They want to make sure that the project is a full go before they really begin to celebrate there.
And this is a lovely old building. The Manchester Hotel is almost 100 years old, built back in 1922. Can you share any of the history?
Yes. So the building was originally developed, as you said, back in the 1920s, very successful up until the Great Depression. And then it was later acquired by Armco, which is the predecessor company for AK Steel. And they used it for bringing in kind of business associates and hosting meetings. So it had kind of a second revival there after the Great Depression. But in time, as I-75 was built, and you had other changes happening. It kind of has fallen by the wayside, and in recent years, it's been vacant since 2011.
Let's talk about a project a little closer to our studios here downtown. $31 million mixed use development in OTR. This involves new life for 20 buildings.
Yes, so a big project here from the Model Group and 3CDC. They're planning to partner on a mixed-use redevelopment project that they're calling Findlay Parkside. And really, like I said, this is 20 predominantly vacant buildings around the Findlay Playground. So a lot of buildings on Vine Street, some on East McMicken, and it's planned to build on what's already happening kind of around the Findlay Market area and expand that over to Vine Street. And one of the things that Model and 3CDC told me is that they're looking to include a mix of income apartments here. So it wouldn't all just be kind of the what you think of like the luxury or top-end rental units. They'll have some workforce housing, so units that are more affordable to people who may be working in the neighborhood, trying to provide a variety of housing options with this project.
And it's going to create significant construction jobs and then dozens of permanent jobs, apparently.
Yes. So as a part of this, 3CDC will be handling the street-level commercial space, and they're really focused on bringing in kind of the right mix of retailers, making sure they're bringing in some minority-owned businesses to the neighborhood, and really programming that commercial space to make sure it makes the most sense with all the other uses nearby. And as you said, in terms of construction jobs, you're looking at almost 500 construction jobs as they work on this, and about 80 permanent jobs for Over the Rhine in those commercial spaces.
And we should see construction begin rather soon, and even completion not long after, apparently.
Yes. So a Model Group and 3CDC are pretty positive about being able to close on their financing and start construction in mid-2021, and looking at finishing this project up about a year, probably a year and a half later.
We're talking with Tom DeMiropoulos from the Cincinnati Business Courier. And Tom, we've been talking a lot about historic tax credits in some of your reporting this week. There's another local landmark that would like to be referenced as a local historic landmark, and that's the Mercantile Library. Our friends over at the library put on such great programming during this pandemic. What are they trying to do?
Yeah, so this is a building downtown at 4th and Walnut that is, in addition to being home to the Mercantile Library, it has about 10 floors of office space. And at this time, the ownership there is looking at their options to see what makes, the most sense for that building going forward. And as they were going through that process, and they're working again with Model Group, they found out that the building is not a historic landmark, which was kind of a shock to them. So they thought, well, we better go through this process, get this building on the local historic landmark and get that designation, because that opens up access to state and federal tax credits in case they want to do anything with the building going forward. That's a, you know, those are really vital tools for development and redevelopment of buildings. It really helps those developers make those projects make sense.
Tom, you've had a pretty busy week by the load of content I've read from you, so I hope you enjoy a nice weekend and a happy holiday. Tom Demaropoulos from The Business Courier, always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Michael. You too.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. During this pandemic, we've tried a variety of ways to keep kids learning, and it turns out 100 years ago during that flu pandemic, local educators sought alternatives as well to contain the spread and to keep kids educated. And then further back in 1850, Cincinnati celebrated meat at Christmas. Local historian and the writer behind the blog Cincinnati Curiosities, Greg Hand, joins us now via Zoom. Greg, welcome back to our program.
Happy to be here.
So at the beginning of the show, we were talking with our reporter Corey Sharber here at WVXU about Cincinnati Public Schools' plans to return to some type of in-person learning early next year. This was a concern for educators during that other pandemic that took place a century ago. What was the cure for sick kids during the Spanish influenza?
You know, when Corey was talking, obviously I saw the parallels there, but Jolene's report on outdoor dining also plays into this, because 100 years ago, a little more than 100 years ago, in the middle of the Spanish flu, as it was called at the time, the Cincinnati Public Schools were working on a project to teach children out of doors. The idea being that fresh air was extremely helpful and healthful, and that this was a way to not only encourage learning, but to improve the overall health of the school children in Cincinnati, and actually opened up maybe a dozen classrooms where children were taught year-round in an outdoor setting.
So when we think about year-round in Cincinnati, we don't exactly have the type of climate that makes outdoor time always enjoyable. So I imagine they didn't have those large electric heaters that we're seeing outside of a lot of our restaurants. What did they do to make people comfortable while learning outside in the cold?
So this is exactly the case. The belief of these people, and you have to really wonder what sort of sadistic people were in charge of these programs. They believed that the colder the air, the more healthful. And so wintertime was prime season for outdoor classrooms. And what they would do is clothe the children in what were called Eskimo suits. And these were sort of full body coveralls that buttoned up the front. And the kids sat there in these coveralls in the photographs without hats while they were getting their lectures in the middle of the winter.
Oh my gosh. So it was really like a school uniform of sorts that was designed to keep them warm. What was there anything that lingered beyond this, beyond the flu pandemic? Were schools in the local area continuing this outdoor teaching opportunity?
Now, the interesting thing is, while this was going on during the pandemic, it really had very little to do with the pandemic. The big reason for these outdoor schools was an ongoing plague of tuberculosis in Cincinnati, and the idea being that more fresh air was a way of eliminating tuberculosis. And there is a legacy of these schools. In addition to the public schools, a woman in Clifton started a private outdoor school. That was Helen Lotsbeach. And her school, the Lotsbeach School, eventually became one of the components that merged to form Seven Hills School, which is still in existence.
How about that? You can always find something interesting from Greg Hand, where he digs up all these cool stories, not the least of which is our next story that I have to say was a very easy sell here when I was pitching it in our news meeting. Cincinnati's 1850 Christmas Meat Parade Greg, this sounds like a story perfectly tailored for you. What can you tell us about this?
This is one of my favorites. You know, back in the 1850s, no one in Cincinnati, surprisingly, had a refrigerator. And so if you were going to purchase meat for your dinner, you would likely purchase it that day. And since the biggest feasts involving meat took place on Christmas, the local butchers decided to show people the day before what was going to be available for their Christmas dinner. And they did this for several years by creating a parade of meat through downtown Cincinnati all the way to the Fifth Street Market.
Okay, so the materials that you provided me to understand what the meat parade was indicate that it included more than 500 animals and the hired marching band, so it was quite a spectacle, and I want to quote part of your writing on this, quote, 66 bullocks, of which probably three-fourths were raised and am I allowed to say bullocks on the air? 66 bullocks, of which probably three-fourths were raised and fed in Kentucky and the residue in our own state. 125 sheep hung up whole at the edges of the stalls. 350 pigs displayed in rows on platforms. 10 of the finest and fattest bears Missouri could produce. And a buffalo calf weighing 500 pounds caught a Santa Fe constituted the materials for this Christmas pageant. I don't know if that sounds horrible or delicious.
One of the things that you'll notice is in that listing of the animals in the meat parade, which, as you'd indicated, also included marching bands, military units marched along with this, school children got involved. But one of the things you'll notice is there's no turkeys or geese or any poultry. In the 1850s and into the 1860s, Cincinnati wanted red meat for their Christmas feast. And so that's what was available through the butchers of the Fifth Street Market and featured in the meat parade. The source that you were quoting, Charles Sist, also indicates that something just shy of 100,000 pounds of meat was purchased and devoured on Christmas Day each year in Cincinnati at that time.
It's so interesting, Greg, that these days you can't wait to the last minute to go out and get whatever main course you want to serve at your Christmas dinner. But it sounds like 170 years ago now, that's exactly what you had to do.
Indeed. And in fact, it's one of the infamous books about Cincinnati, Fanny Trollope's Manners of the Americans, makes fun of Cincinnatians because it wasn't the servants who went out and did the shopping. It was usually the head of the household, the man who went out and did the shopping for the dinner that evening.
So interesting the way some things change and some things don't, like alternative means of education. You can always find these very cool stories from Cincinnati's past at Cincinnati Curiosities. That's Greg Hand's blog. You definitely should follow him on Twitter. He always puts an update, a this day in history kind of thing. That's always enjoyable, just like the conversations we get to have with him. Greg, thanks so much for sharing some more time with us. Hopefully we get to talk again in January about some weird New Year's stuff.
You got it. I'll be ready.
Thanks, Greg. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. This is our last program of 2020. We're off for a couple of weeks. There'll be holiday programming on in our place. We thank you for all the time you gave us during 2020, and we look forward to talking again in 2021. On behalf of our producer, Selena Reeder, our assistant producer, Nick Swartzel, and our technical director, Josh Elstro, I'm Michael Monks, wishing you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.